Going to read from 1 Samuel chapter 1. If you'd like to turn that up. Going to skip some verses, but you'll be able to catch up with me. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Okay. There was a certain man called Elkanah, and he had two wives. One was called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow, saying, "O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine." "Not so, my lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favour in your eyes." Then she went away and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah lay with Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him."
The title of our talk this session is When God is in Charge. And the church I come from, we have some songs that we sing that children love to sing. And we sing these songs with great gusto. There's two that we sing. "My God is so big, so great and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do." That's true. Thank you. The second song, I'm just going to read the first couple of verses of this song that we're going to sing together. "Jesus is the mighty, mighty King. Jesus is the mighty, mighty King. God made him the boss of everything, and Jesus is the mighty, mighty King." And the second verse says, "Now you are not the boss, I am not the boss, They are not the boss, Jesus is the boss, because Jesus is the mighty, mighty King."
Would you please turn the tape over at this point?
So you understand when the title of the talk is When God is in Charge. You know, this song presents a huge and important theological truth. And we teach it to our kids. But do we understand it? And are we prepared to live by it? What happens when we face difficulty in our lives? And what happens when we pray to our God who can do anything and find that God does not step in to our circumstances in the way that we would like? Earlier this morning, we rejoiced in the possibility of an up-close and personal relationship with the Father. Now I want to look at what it means to pray honestly, "Your will be done." Praying "Your will be done" when life is sailing along happily is no problem. Praying "Your will be done" is challenged when life is difficult. "Your will be done" means aligning our wills with God's will, and it is the very tough stuff of the Christian life. What we are going to discover this morning is that we may be called upon to give up our dreams and our plans and submit to God's timing when answers are a long time coming. We might be asked to submit to God's purpose when confident faith is challenged. And we might be asked to submit to God's wisdom when events do not make any sense. None of these things is easy, and I don't want to be glib about this, because I understand from my own experience, so I guess from yours, that we have faced these times when we haven't got the expected answers that we thought and felt we needed. This is important and serious. The first person, and we're going to look at this through three events in the Bible, and when I come to Bible stories, I remember these are real people. Hannah, that we read about, was a real person who lived in a real place. And you know, when we read the Bible over long, long years, we come used to the stories and we forget the emotion. We forget what happened to these people. We just read it and then that's okay. But for the people who experienced these things, it was trauma. As real as the trauma that you and I experience. So first of all, we'll look at Hannah. Hannah prays for a child, and the answer was a long time coming. Life was very difficult for Hannah. She had some problems. She had a personal problem. She was infertile. She had a family problem. Her husband had other wives, another wife, Peniah. And Peniah had children. And Peniah was a very spiteful lady. So Hannah had a family problem because Peniah was very proud of that she had been able to produce children so easily, and scorned Hannah's infertility. Hannah had a social problem as well. Not to have children was a social disgrace. I mean, it was bad enough if you had just daughters. If you had sons, well, fine. You fitted into the social fabric of the society very well, and you had an honoured place. But Hannah didn't even have daughters. She had no children at all. So she had a social problem. And Hannah had a spiritual problem as well. God was not answering her prayers for a child. How do you think she felt? I guess some of you tune in. Maybe you've had one of these or some of these problems. Personal problem, family problem, a social problem, and a spiritual problem. How do you deal with it when God does not answer your prayers? Hannah was loved by her husband Elkanah, and he could not solve her problem. And the language in this story is very, very emotional. Did you notice? Hannah was weeping. Hannah was downhearted. Hannah was bitter, miserable, couldn't eat. She was deeply troubled, in great anguish and grief. How did she feel? Do you get the picture? For Hannah, life was, every day for Hannah, life was an ordeal. Even though her husband loved her. And in some ways that was unusual. He loved her even though she had not given him any sons. But he loved her. So she was a lovely person. She was a nice person, but who had all these problems. And so dealt with them however she could, emotionally. And you know what she does, even though she's got all these problems and God hadn't answered? She still clings to God. She clung to God year after year after year. We know how long it takes to have a baby, don't we? And how old is your little baby? 3 months. We know how long it takes. And Panaya had, I don't know how many children, lots. So how many years? How many years had Hannah waited for God's answer? And how painful was that? What was God's purpose in allowing Hannah to suffer all these years of great sadness? You know, as I looked at the story and thought about it, I think that God was preparing Hannah through suffering to be the mother of Samuel. Through suffering, she became a godly woman and a godly mother. God entrusted Samuel to her for the very early years of his life for a very special purpose, because Samuel was to be God's man at a critical time in Israel's history. So do you get what was happening that Hannah didn't know? Hannah was being subjected to God's timing. Okay? You see, when we have to wait a long time for a prayer to be answered, we think that God doesn't understand, does he? We need the answer now? Well, at the latest next week. Because we know why we need the answer, don't we? It's very important. We need the answer. And so we go to God like Hannah. And look, if you haven't gone to God weeping and crying, be surprised. And you give up going to God? Hannah didn't. But she didn't know what the delay was for. She didn't know the purpose of the delay. If she'd known, how would it have been different? Very different. What if God had said to Hannah when she married Elkanah, "Now, Hannah, I'm just telling you this so you won't be distressed. Panaya's going to have lots of children and it's going to be a lot of years before you have a baby, but you're going to have this special baby for this special purpose." How do you think Hannah would have lived in that household? She might have said, "Well, this is my secret. I'm not telling Panaya." Panaya thinks, you know, she's got it all over me. What might she have become if she'd known the answer ahead of time? A little proud. A little, you know. God's got a special thing for me to do. And he's told me. So, this whole thing is about waiting for God's timing. That is so difficult. And why did God let us suffer? I don't know. Except I'm just guessing. that by the time she went and Eli saw her weeping and crying, she was in great distress. He recognised a woman deeply committed to God but in deep trouble. And Eli wasn't the best priest in the land. And yet Eli, okay, I think I know God is going to answer your prayer. And Hannah goes in peace. Hannah, at last, what did she do? She believed that God would do something. That God would give her a child. And so he did. And this child was for this time in this nation's history. And what do you think Hannah taught Samuel in those first few years she had him at home? What do you think she taught him? Cling to God, Samuel. Whatever happens, cling to God. And Samuel, life's not going to be a dream for you. She didn't know what God's purpose was for Samuel, but Samuel played a very, very important role in Israel's history. He anointed Saul as king, then he anointed David as king. He was God's man. Where did he learn? Where did he learn the basics of relationship to God? He learnt it from Hannah, who had suffered, but who had clung to God and believed that God would do what he said he would do in his time. And so, she named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." And then she carries out what she said she would do. She said, "I will give this man back to you, Lord." How hard do you think that was? I don't know how old he was. Commentators differ, 3 or 5, perhaps, when he went to the temple and was left there. How difficult do you think it was for Hannah to give up this loved child? It wasn't easy. But if you look in 1 Samuel chapter 1, towards the end of it, and they went, and when she took Samuel, after he was weaned, 1 Samuel 1:24, after he was weaned, she took the boy with her, young as he was, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When they had slaughtered the bull, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, "As surely as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he shall be given over to the Lord." And he worshipped the Lord there. So when God gave what Hannah asked, Hannah was true to the promise she had made to God. Ladies, you better be careful. If you ask God for something and make a promise that you will fulfill if he answers your prayer, take care that you fulfill it. My father was a young boy of 19. He left home at 15 to sail the world from the Shetland Islands, which are far off the north coast of Scotland. He went all sorts of places, and he landed in Adelaide in 1913 on a ship. And he was very sick and was left behind by his ship. I'm not sure whether it was in Adelaide or in Sydney that he had an accident. He was drawn into a winch on the ship with his right arm. And as he was going into the winch, his right arm was torn off to here. He asked God to save him, and he would serve him. He lost his right arm, and he gave all of his life to the service of God. And he was the most godly and contented and happy man. Sometimes it is difficult to submit to God's timing, but it is worthwhile if we cling to God and learn the lessons that he has for us to learn in the process. The second story I want to take you to is in John chapter 11. So when answers are a long time coming, we need to submit to God's timing. John chapter 11. We haven't got time to read the whole story. Do you know the story of Mary and Martha? We will read a little bit of it. John chapter 11. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for 2 more days. This is a story of what happens when faith certainty is challenged and we need to submit to God's purpose. Have you ever prayed something very confidently, assured that this was God's will, and the answer hasn't come? Have you ever felt that you've looked at your life and you thought, well, I've confessed sin, I've in order, and I'm confidently believing that God has given me this promise? It doesn't happen. What do you do? The experience here of Mary and Martha is an experience like that. You know, Mary and Martha knew Jesus well. He was a regular visitor in their home. They also believed that he was who he claimed to be, the Son of God. And when their brother Lazarus was sick, they knew exactly what to do. Call Jesus. No hesitation. He will come and heal Lazarus. Their faith was absolutely watertight. No niggling doubts here. Absolutely sure. No wondering if this was the will of God. They knew this was what Jesus did. They had seen him do miracles for other people. Why wouldn't he do a miracle for them? And what's more, they were his best friends. He was welcome in their home. They knew him better than anybody else. Why wouldn't he come? Of course he would. Just send the message. And notice the message that they sent to Jesus. It was loaded. Loaded with emotion. "Lord, the one you love is sick." Is this manipulation? It's pretty strong language, isn't it? "Lord, the one you love." You know, this is not for me. This is for Lazarus. "The one you love is sick." And then they sat back and waited for Jesus to come. What happened when Lazarus died? They were absolutely shattered. Now, I don't mean that they were disappointed. They were shattered. Do you know what that feels like? So were their neighbours and friends shattered. How do I know this? The Bible tells me. The Bible records both Mary and Martha saying to the Lord when he did come, verses 21, 11 and 21. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Verse 32. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Now look at verse 36 and 37. The people who were watching, the neighbours, the friends. Verse 36, the Jews said, "See how he loved him," that's Lazarus, but some of them said, "Could not he have opened Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" What do you think the neighbours and friends were saying to Mary and Martha? "Ha ha, what's the use of being good friends with Jesus? What good has it done you?" No good at all. He's dead. And don't you think, you know, these were cruel words, weren't they? You know, they said, you know, he's healed the blind and the deaf. Don't you think he could have kept this man alive? If Jesus won't act on behalf of a godly family, who will he act for? Is that what we ask ourselves in this circumstance? But we have to see Jesus' side of the story. Verse 4 reveals Jesus' love for the family and also his purpose in delaying returning to Bethany. Verse 4, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Again, this is similar to what we said about Hannah, God's purpose, God's timing. So it's important to notice that God had a purpose for Mary and Martha's good, but Mary and Martha didn't know it. And that's the challenge to us when prayers are not answered in the way that we perceive they should be. What is God's purpose? Are we willing to hang around long enough to find out? If they had known ahead of time, this story would have been totally different, wouldn't it? Totally different. If they had said after he died, "Well, no worries, everybody, just hang around, Jesus will be here and he'll raise him from the dead." Wouldn't they? If they knew. But they didn't know. And this is the story of our lives. Our lives. We often don't know what God's purpose is for us. So we need to trust this God who we don't understand. So God's purpose was that to Mary and Martha he would reveal the most wonderful truth of the Christian faith. Hear this? The resurrection. And who did he display it to in this marvellous scene? Two women. Hang on. Isn't this a society where men are the keepers of all wisdom and knowledge? Isn't this that sort of society that Mary and Martha lived in? And what is Jesus doing? For Mary and Martha, right up close and personal, he is showing them the truth of the resurrection. How amazing. What a wonderful God who will do this for two village women in Bethany. Verse 32 and 38 reveals Jesus' heart for the suffering of Mary and Martha. Verse 33 says, Jesus was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And verse 35 says, Jesus wept. And verse 38 says, Jesus once more was deeply moved. Why was that when Jesus knew what he was doing? You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of what we learnt this morning out of Hebrews, that we have a high priest touched with the feelings of our infirmities. Jesus didn't swan in and just without regard to these people's emotion. Jesus didn't say, "Just stand aside and watch what I'm going to do." Jesus understood the pain and the suffering that these women experienced while they waited for him to come. Do you get this for yourself? Jesus understands your pain and suffering as you wait for his purpose to be fulfilled. Hebrews said he's our great high priest, touched with the feelings of our infirmities. I love those verses because it tells me what kind of a God I have. There's a very special verse in Isaiah 63 that I love. And it was speaking about Israel, and God speaks and he says, "Surely they are my people, sons who will not be false to me." And so he became their saviour. In all their distress, he too was distressed, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and mercy he redeemed them. He lifted them up and carried them all the days of old. That was Israel he's talking about. In all their distress, God was distressed. I found that verse years ago when a friend of mine told me a very distressing event that had happened in her family, and I was very angry that it had happened, and I was very distressed, and I said, "What was God doing when this happened? And why did this happen? And this is not right. What does God feel about these sort of things when they happen?" And I found this verse: God was distressed for all their distress, and Jesus was distressed for Mary and Martha's pain. But God's purpose was to make the resurrection a reality to this family and to his disciples. And he said, "I am the resurrection and the life." Verse 41. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen, and a cloth around his head. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Jesus needed to show his power over death to these disciples before he went to the cross. And if you look at this story now from Jesus' side, what a privileged family this was. How the story has changed. What a privilege that he showed his power over death to this family, this little family in Bethany, that he was the resurrection and the life. You see, God's purpose was greater than they anticipated. All they wanted was their sick brother made whole. I mean, that was a pretty big ask, but that's what they wanted, didn't they? That was the best thing that could have happened in their lives, that their brother be returned to health. But what was God's purpose? That they understand that he was the Son of God and had power over death, that he was what he said, the resurrection and the life. So ladies, the lesson? When confident faith is challenged, we need to submit to God's purpose. And sometimes it takes a long time coming to know God's purpose. But we need to trust God's purpose in those circumstances, and to understand that God understands our pain and our suffering in the process. The third story I want to bring to you is in Acts 12, 1 to 12. This is a circumstance when events defy explanation. What do we have to submit to then? We have to submit to God's wisdom. When events do not make sense, we need to submit to God's wisdom. Now that's okay, isn't it, on paper? Come to an event in your life and the story is different. Come to this event in these people's lives. Acts 12 is the story, a story that I heard often in Sunday school. It's a great story for Sunday school, isn't it? Peter's miraculous escape from prison. Verse 1 of chapter 12. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. Hear that? When he saw that this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to the guards by four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. The night before Herod was to bring him to trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Suddenly an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him up. "Quick, get up," he said, and the chains fell off Peter's wrists. Then the angel said to him, "Put on your clothes and sandals," and Peter did so. "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," the angel told him. Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and second guards and came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them by itself, and they went through it. When they had walked the length of one street, suddenly the angel left him. Then Peter came to himself and said, "Now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating," which meant his death. When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked at the door at the outer entrance, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognised Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed she ran back without opening it and said, "Peter's at the door." "You're out of your mind," they said. You notice that they were praying he'd be released. When she kept insisting... You notice that? When she kept insisting that it was so, they said it must be an angel. They even said, "Well, it's not Peter, is it? Because he's in prison." But Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. He'd gone and answered their prayer. Come on. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. "Tell James and the brothers about this," he said, and then he left for another place. I guess too high. In the morning there was no small commotion among the soldiers as to what had become of Peter. After Herod had a thorough search made for him and did not find him, he cross-examined the guards and ordered that they be executed. You know, the story that I heard in Sunday school was the story often of Peter's escape. I don't remember hearing that James was beheaded. What do you think the family of James felt about this? Why was James beheaded? Don't you think the church was praying for James just as much as they were praying for Peter? Do you think the family of James said, "Oh, hallelujah, Peter's been released and James been killed"? I don't think so. Don't you think they would be wondering, what is God doing? You know, if an angel could get Peter out of this place, surely an angel could have got James out of this place. Not too hard, surely. What was God's wisdom in this? I don't know. Both of these men were part of the church at Jerusalem. Both were Jesus' disciples. But one was killed and the other was released. It raises a question that perhaps some of you have asked. Why was this one taken? Why was this one left? Why was this person healed and that child not? What's the wisdom here? These events do not make sense. For the last 7 years, I have had this brochure on my office wall, and I have prayed off and on for the last 7 years for these families. Do you know what this is? In 1993, on January the 31st, three men, missionaries with New Tribes Mission, were kidnapped in South America, Panama. Three wonderful missionary men kidnapped. How many years on are we? 8 years? No word. Nobody knows what's happened to them. Nobody knows. For a few years they thought they were still alive. They're probably dead. What are these and I have said to God, there's too few missionaries on the field anyway. We need all the missionaries we've got. Why allow these three to go, to disappear? What about these families? What about these children? Dora 12, Lee 5, Connie 7, that was in 1993. How old are these children now? Tamara 6, Jessica 4, 8 years ago. What is their mother saying to these children? How are they coping with these events that do not make sense? Why have these men just disappeared? What are they being asked to do? To submit to God's wisdom? I think that's about the biggest ask you could be asked to bear. It is hard enough to accept the death or a tragedy to a loved one that you know and you can see and you can be around, or to accept it. You know, death that you can finish off by having a service or a funeral or a memorial service. How do they cope? What do they do? What is God's wisdom in this? You see, in these sort of circumstances, we have a choice to believe that God is wise in ways that we know nothing of and to cling to Him still. It's a great and perplexing issue, and we need to be aware that people in our community, in our churches, our friends, might be being asked to accept God's wisdom in circumstances that they find impossible to understand from a logical point of view. In these situations, I offer no pat answer. All I say is that Jesus understands the suffering as he understands Martha and Mary's, and that God is distressed by our distresses, and that God is a God of all comfort for those who will, as best they can, submit to his timing, to his purpose, or to his wisdom. And today, for you, I don't know who this message is for, but I know that the God of all wisdom is also the God of all comfort, and his purposes will be fulfilled. And if you don't get to know them here, you will get to know them in eternity.